Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. Today we have a new author, yet another in the huge library of authors we've covered on the Reality Revolution. Today we have Walter M. Germain. And Germain, as far as I can tell, was an American author who wrote and lectured on parapsychology. He was also a police officer for the Saginaw Police Department in the 50s, and he began writing on ESP and other aspects of parapsychology. He wrote a book called The Magic Power of Your Mind. This is one of those classics a lot of people don't really write about when they write about different self-help books. But it was written in 1956, and chapter by chapter, it's great. And I definitely plan on dedicating a couple of episodes to this book. He talks about everything from intuition, the super sense, magic in your mind, generating power in different ways, using your mind, and has a very persuasive way of discussing it. Today I wanted to dedicate an episode on rediscovering your super sense. The reason I'm interested in this is the idea that we are going to awaken with another sense, a sense that we've already had for a long time, but we're going to rediscover it. We know of the five senses that we have. We can see, we can taste, we can touch, we can smell, we can hear our environment. But what would it be like to be conscious in a body with additional senses? Well, it may already be true. There is a super sense that we have that we are slowly going to become aware of. And we need to find a way to talk about it because many people are experiencing this super sense. It's a sort of intuition that's unlike other intuitions that we've had in the past. And it's interesting to go back and read a book from a long ago that discusses this in a powerful way. Rediscovering Your Super Sense by Walter M. Germain. You have perhaps often used one of the greatest powers of your mind. You've used it and perhaps wondered a little bit about it, or you have thanked good fortune for having shown you the way and not bothered to think about it. What is this power? Why have you not used it more often? Can you now utilize it to its fullest extent? The answer to the last question is yes. Yes, as often as you want, when you learn what it is and how you can use it. You have undoubtedly done things on a hunch at some time or other, and later discovered that you were correct in following this unexplained direction. Perhaps you've had it sometime, had a feeling that led you to take the correct action in some activity, a feeling that you later probably called a sixth sense. Perhaps you may have been sitting at your telephone and thinking, so-and-so ought to call me. I have something very important to tell him, and I can't reach him, then within minutes, have the person in question telephone you. Perhaps you've been on your way home when, for no apparent reason, you stopped to buy a particular article. Then, upon arrival home, you have been told that had you telephoned, you've been asked to stop to buy that very article. Maybe you've been at a gathering when suddenly you went to find the person you came with and said, "You want to go home now, don't you?" and discovered your impression was correct. You called them hunches or attributed them to a sixth sense. You may perhaps sneer when someone talks about mental telepathy. Yet, your so-called hunches or impressions resulting from your so-called sixth sense are no more incredulous than mental telepathy. What you perhaps fail to realize is that in addition to the five senses of the conscious level, seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, and smelling, there is a sense belonging to the superconscious level of the mind. It is a form of communication you are not familiar with. You encounter it infrequently. You notice it only in such rare instances as have been listed above. Yet it apparently is functioning even more thoroughly than the five senses of the conscious level. From what little is known of it, the superconscious sense, unlike the five senses, never rests. It is the supersense. From what little can be garnered of dead civilizations, the supersense is nothing new to man's knowledge. It apparently was known and used in ages past. Why? Science is only now setting about rediscovering the supersense is something that may never be explained. The supersense is in reality a double sense. It has all the powers of mental television in addition to all the powers of mental radio. To telepathy, the telegraph of the supersense, is not abnormal. Eileen J. Garrett, writing in Telepathy in Search of a Lost Faculty, says telepathy is part of the creative faculty, further substantiating the theory that the supersense and the superconscious can help you mold a new life for yourself. Mrs. Garrett writes, if you grant it is within your powers to improve yourself in any way, then you are able to achieve that improvement in self-expression by developing telepathic, clairvoyant, and clairaudient powers. You see, therefore, that within you lies the power to make for yourself a regenerated life. There lies before you, when you tap this power potential of the superconscious, the ability to help yourself live a longer, healthier, and more useful life. In your hands rests the ability to create for yourself new power of wealth and new concepts of happiness. Can you see yourself adding years to your life? Can you picture yourself a newer, healthier person, untroubled by the degenerative diseases of aging? Can you see yourself moving ahead in business, creating new ventures, making wise investments? Can you see yourself doing all the things you have dreamed of doing but felt incapable of accomplishing? Can you see a future with unlimited opportunity opening up in all aspects of living? There are no pipe dreams. They are not castles in the air. They are reality within your reach if you are willing to learn to understand the powers of the superconscious. The superconscious level of the mind, like the unconscious level, has means of communicating with the same level in other persons. As the conscious mind developed, man developed his ability to communicate by speaking. But in so doing, it appears he lost the faculty of utilizing the communication level of the superconscious. It seems highly plausible that before ancient man began to make distinguishable sounds, talk with his vocal cords, he communicated by sense, or rather supersense. The superconscious is an entity unto itself with many powers. Not only does it store vast amounts of information rapidly and accurately, but it has the powers to transmit to and receive information from the superconscious of other persons. Just how this works, no one has yet discovered. Whether the psychologist or the neurosurgeon will first come on the secret and supply mankind with the answer is a question to which only time can reply. It has long been known, however, that the electrochemical processes we call thought create vibrations. These thought vibrations have been electrically recorded. It appears that these thought vibrations, utilizing the power of the superconscious level, act much the same as radio waves. Under certain ideal circumstances, thought transmission is little different from radio transmission. The superconscious acts in much the same manner as a radio transmitter. In order to transmit messages or broadcast, the modulation frequency of radio must be increased to a pitch of sound waves in the ether. And in order to have these messages audible to the human ear at the receiving end, they must be reduced again to a lower frequency. What happens in mental thought transmission is identical. The rate of thought vibration is increased to be transmittable. The power to transmit the message comes as well from the superconscious. It has been said that the superconscious is not only the brain's memory storehouse, it is also the brain's powerhouse. The source of the brain's hidden power is emotion. The stronger the emotion, the more powerful the transmission of the thought patterns from the superconscious and the conscious level. One of the most unusual experiences I've had in the reception of a telepathic message from another person illustrates vividly how the emotional powerhouse is responsible for the energizing of the transmission ability of the mind. As an inspector of the police department in charge of crime prevention at Saginaw, Michigan, I was interviewing a local businesswoman one day not too many years ago regarding a theft. She was relating to me at considerable length and in some unnecessary detail the circumstances surrounding the theft of money from her purse. The boy whom she suspected of the larceny was well known to me in similar circumstances. I felt certain he was guilty of this theft. Because of this fact, I did not listen too attentively to the long recital the woman was making in relating the circumstances of this latest of his petty thievery. I allowed my mind to concentrate subjectively while I pondered certain peculiar aspects of her facial expressions. I began to sense that something more than the theft of the money was bothering this woman. I wondered what the trouble could be when suddenly I was possessed with an irresistible urge to talk to her about the most unusual idea that had flashed through my conscious mind. This thought seemed fantastic and irrational to my reason, but the urge was so unmistakably in the same category I had had, and other people had had, in the field of extrasensory perception. I felt I had to do something about it. I decided to chance telling the woman of the extraordinary impression that had flashed across the threshold of my consciousness as I studied the perplexing signs of deep mental stress and anxiety showing on her face as she talked to me. "I think I know who took the $5 from your pocketbook," I said to her. Then I added, a little more cautiously, "but I would like to talk to you about a more serious matter, if you don't mind." She looked at me with a sort of expectancy, which indicated to me that she sensed the impact of my deep feeling of sympathy for her perturbed mental state. She only muttered quickly, "Of course not, go ahead." Then she appeared almost breathless as she waited for the words she must have felt were ominous. "You've been contemplating suicide." My voice was quiet, and in comparison, her exclamation seemed to tear through the room. "My God, how'd you know that?" She turned deathly pale. I explained quite frankly that I did not know how I came to know the fact that she planned self-destruction. I told her, however, that I suspected it was the so far unexplained phenomenon called telepathy. This seemed to stabilize her wits, and we were able to discuss her situation quite calmly and objectively. The misunderstanding responsible for her terrible obsession was easy to point out to her as we openly discussed the circumstances of her family discord without hiding or distorting any facts. I feel sure that our conversation released the nervous tension underlying this good woman's mental disturbance, but that is something I wish to discuss later on. While I have not seen this woman since her visit to my office in the 40s, though she still lives in Saginaw and would corroborate my story, perhaps it is not assuming too much to believe that this instant of my super sense at work may have saved her life. So we come upon evidence of the correctness of the sixth proposition of the working hypothesis. The supraconscious has the power to communicate by means other than the recognized channels of the five senses. All of my telepathic experiences have been spontaneous ones. I have not ever attempted to use my supersense for such communication, but I feel certain that the supersense is a vital part of the golden gift. I will tell you later how I discovered the constant functioning of the supersense in mass communication with all persons without the awareness of the conscious level. In each of the telepathic experiences I've had, I've been aware of deep emotional stirring, usually in a sympathetic attitude of helpfulness for someone. I therefore believe that the phenomenon of telepathy takes place when the human nervous system attains a certain intensity of mutual frequency, which permits the transference of thoughts from one person to another at the subjective level of consciousness. The emotional stirring I've experienced, providing the necessary power for the transmission of thoughts from the superconscious, is an experience everyone has had at some time or other. The experience of telepathy as a result is also an experience common to most people at some time. Most have not been sufficiently interested in taking more than passing notice of the unusual manifestations. In my own case, the overall problem of the work in which I was involved gave my emotional nature a certain responsive fluidity which the average person does not have the opportunity to acquire and develop. For many years, I have done research into the problem of juvenile delinquency. I have sought a workable solution to the behavior difficulties of young people who get into trouble with the law. This aroused my interest in many phases of human nature with which a person ordinarily does not come in contact. The conditioning of my emotional reactions has come from handling thousands of problem children. They were always handled with sympathy and understanding of the erring youngster and his unsolved problems. This sensitizing of my supersense led me to the discoveries I have made in the realm of the supersense and the superconscious. Yet my discoveries took me further into the fields of telepathy and like phenomena. They astonished me when I discovered it was well established that telepathy is known as the means of communication between minds beyond the conscious level, that is, between the superconscious levels of the human brain. And the communication of the supersense is a never-ending function. It is a constant stream of telegraphy going from mind to mind, despite the fact that the conscious knows nothing of its occurrence. Your superconscious, as you know now, is a vast storehouse of knowledge. Where this knowledge comes from is apparent. The SuperSense radio is constantly receiving communications from the minds of all people around you. Your superconscious is constantly accumulating new stores of knowledge through this telepathic communication. Perhaps the most amazing case on record of such accumulation of knowledge by the superconscious mind is that of Edgar Cayce, the so-called miracle man of Virginia Beach. There are many stories of the powers Cayce was able to utilize after he discovered that he could use them, and some of these I will discuss later. First, I want to tell you how he performed phenomena that were called in his time and today would be too miracles. Yet they were, by the words of his own superconscious mind, only the use of the accumulated knowledge within that level of the golden gift. Edgar Cayce, as a boy of 12, first experienced phenomena that were termed psychic. He discovered then, unwittingly, though by means of clairvoyance, the powers of the superconscious. But his use of the accumulated knowledge of the superconscious and the collective unconscious did not come until he was grown to manhood. Through chance and a misfortune, Cayce and scientific researchers discovered his ability to call on powers which startled the world. Edgar Cayce had worked as a salesman. When he lost the use of his voice, he returned to his home at Hopkinsville, Kentucky, where he took a job as a photographer's apprentice. An entertainer known as Hart the Lao King was booked into the opera house where he was to give an exhibition of hypnotism. Virtually all of the townspeople in Hopkinsville went to Holland's Opera House to watch the fun. Hart entertained the people in the usual fashion, putting members of the audience into hypnotic trance and having them do all manner of amusing things for the enjoyment of their friends and relatives. Someone spoke to Hart about Cayce's condition. While the hypnotist was not a therapist, he was interested in the results of post-hypnotic suggestion and thought he might be able to help the young man. While in a hypnotic trance, Cayce was able to speak quite normally. Awakened, he could not speak, only in a hoarse whisper, and the post-hypnotic suggestion apparently failed. Hart tried a second time, but the post-hypnotic suggestion again did not succeed with Cayce. However, Dr. John P. Quackenboss, a New York physician, later heard of the matter directly from Professor William Guirao of the psychology department at South Kentucky College. Dr. Quackenboss had great faith in the possibility of curing illness by hypnotism. It was his belief that in post-hypnotic suggestion, a patient could be healed by directing the mind to remove the cause of the ailment. Dr. Quackenboss tried his skill on Cayce, but he too failed. Later, however, Dr. Quackenboss wrote to the South Kentucky professor with the theory that Cayce failed to respond to the post-hypnotic suggestion because Casey's own superconscious took charge while in the hypnotic state, not the mind of the hypnotist. Dr. Quackenboss based his theory on reports of similar occurrences in France some years earlier. The French cases showed that the patients had had the power of clairvoyance while under hypnosis. Dr. Quackenboss suggested that Edgar Cayce should be put into hypnotic spell and asked about his own illness. Cayce was told about this suggestion and he offered to put himself to sleep in the same way he had done as a boy when studying. As a boy, Cayce had found that if he slept on his school books, he was able to absorb their contents with facility and did not need to study further. Thomas Sugrue describes the experiment in his book There Is a River. Edgar lay down on the family couch, a horsehair sofa that had been part of his grandmother Casey's wedding suite. He put himself to sleep. A1C Lane, a local hypnotist, watching, saw the breathing deepen. There was a long sigh, then the body seemed to sleep. The squire sat in a chair nearby. His wife, nervous, stood up. Lane began to talk in a low, soothing voice, suggesting that Edgar see his body and describe the trouble in the throat. He suggested that Edgar speak in a normal tone of voice. In a few minutes, Edgar began to mumble. Then he cleared his throat and began to speak in a clear, unafflicted voice. "Yes," he said, "we can see the body." "Take it down," Lane said to the squire, Casey's father. The squire looked at him helplessly. The nearest pencil was in the kitchen, tied to the grocery list. "In the normal state," Edgar went on, "this body is unable to speak due to a partial paralysis of the inferior muscles of the vocal cords produced by nerve strain. This is a psychological condition producing a physical effect. This may be removed by increasing the circulation to the affected parts by suggestion while in this unconscious condition. The circulation to the affected parts will now increase, Lane said, and the condition will be removed. Edgar was silent. They watched his throat. The squire leaned over and further loosened his son's shirt. Gradually, the upper part of the chest, then the throat, turned pink. The pink deepened to rose. The rose became a violent red. 10, 15, 20 minutes passed. Edgar cleared his throat again. This is all right now, he said. The condition is removed. Make the suggestion that the circulation return to normal after the body awaken. The circulation will return to normal, Lane said. The body will then awaken. They watched while the red faded back through rose to pink. The skin resumed its normal color. Edgar wakened, sat up, and reached for his handkerchief. He coughed and spat blood. Hello, he said tentatively. Then he grinned. Hey, he said, I can talk, I'm all right. His mother wept. His father seized his hand and shook it again and again. The inevitable result was the suggestion that as Casey had been able to diagnose his own ailment, perhaps under the same conditions, he could do so for others. Edgar was willing to try, and his success was phenomenal. While he actually knew nothing about physiology, biology, anatomy, or medicine, this humble man was able in a hypnotic trance to diagnose all matter of afflictions and ailments. In addition, he was able to prescribe a wide variety of medicine and methods of treatment that invariably affected cures. But Edgar Casey did not understand how he did this. Despite the many successes he had, he was confused and fearful of the ability he possessed. Often he would read and read again stenographic transcripts of what he said while in hypnotic spell, hoping to discover some explanation in his own words of the strange power he possessed. He was amazed at the technical language he used. He was astounded at the scientific knowledge he displayed. Each session's transcripts left him more confused, but he went on with the miraculous successes. But though he continued to search in the transcripts of his own words for some explanation of his power, it never occurred to him to have questions asked of him about the power while he was in his trance state. This method of probing into the discovery of the use of Edgar Casey's golden gift did, however, occur to Dr. Wesley H. Ketchum, a young homeopathic physician who had opened an office in Hopkinsville and became vitally interested in Casey's gift. Dr. Ketchum posed the question to Casey while in a hypnotic state. Casey's answer was included in a published report given before a meeting of the American Society of Clinical Research at Boston in September of 1910. Dr. Ketchum told the gathering of his curiosity in this direction and said that Casey answered the question in the third person. Part of the paper read by Dr. Ketchum follows. When asked the source of his knowledge, he stated, Edgar Casey's mind is amenable to suggestion, the same as all other subconscious minds, but in addition, thereto, it has the power to interpret to the objective mind of others what it acquires from the subconscious mind of other individuals of the same kind. The subconscious mind forgets nothing. The conscious mind receives the impressions from without and transfers all thought to the subconscious, where it retains, even though the conscious is destroyed. Thus it was that Edgar Casey described to the world for the first time what we have come to discover is the superconscious level of the mind. He used the terminology current in that day, but although he did not recognize the fact that he had uncovered the key to the golden gift, that is exactly what he had done. The medical men and scientists who worked with him and who read of his work too failed to realize that they had in Edgar Casey the key to the wondrous treasure of the divine plan of infinite intelligence. Casey, in his hypnotic state, that is, in the control of his superconscious, knew that this level of his mind was in direct communication with the same level of mind in other persons. He knew, too, that the superconscious was capable of interpreting through his objective mind and imparting the impressions received to other objective minds. In this way, he gathered all the knowledge possessed by countless millions of minds through the communications means of the superconscious. Time and space mean nothing to the scope of the superconscious. It appears obvious that the communication system of the superconscious can reach out for information from the tremendous storehouse of memory of the superconscious of other minds, no matter where they may be. Edgar Casey was never satisfied with the why of his power. He was able to understand the how. This he learned from his own explanation while in hypnosis. He knew absolutely nothing of the laws governing human nature. Consequently, he did not realize that the powers that made him different were the fruits of his own efforts. They were the attributes of deeper consciousness from which the essence and substance of spirituality is nurtured through individual conscious effort. These great powers are possessed by all humans, but they are undeveloped. Edgar Cayce did not know this. In him, the development of these powers of the Golden Gift was the end result of his having spent countless hours in childhood reading the Bible and meditating on spiritual aspects of what he read. It is the cause and effect manifestation of the law of use to which this parable refers. For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. In its most simple language, it means that God gives help to those who seek to help themselves. The power of thought transference is not one in which the conscious level necessarily participates. That is to say, that which is being communicated from one superconscious to another is not necessarily something about which either person is consciously thinking. Usually there is no connection whatever with the conscious thoughts of either of the persons involved in the transcommunication on the superconscious level. A message of the utmost importance may therefore never reach the threshold of the percipient's consciousness or even be consciously sent by the agent. You see, therefore, that this telepathic communication possible going on virtually all times, and with development of the super sense and controlled tapping of this additional power of the conscious, there are unlimited horizons open for you to explore, utilize, and profit by. With the power of the super sense untapped consciously, it appears that those persons who are able to utilize this system of communications are developed to some degree psychically. It obviously requires an extraordinary degree of development of psychic power for one to tap the telegraph of the superconscious as a man such as Joseph Dunninger, the popular magician and mentalist, purports to do. Dunninger's demonstrations are authentic, but he requires a large audience in which to communicate on the superconscious level with minds turned to the same emotional frequency as his. The one great beauty of the power of the superconscious means of telecommunication is that the message is never lost. It is not necessary for the conscious level of the mind to tap the power of the supersense in receiving a message at the moment it is received. The great storehouse of memory called the superconscious assures that the message received in all such messages, which apparently are being received at a constant rate, is permanently filled in the bins of knowledge of the Golden Gift. Failure to become objectively conscious of the reception of the message delivered to the superconscious intelligence does not mean, therefore, that the subjectively communicated matter is lost. The recipient of the message may not belong in the class of sensitives able to elevate their subjective impressions to the level of conscious, but hypnosis and other psychic experiments have proved that the information thus received by the superconscious is stored at that level indefinitely. The mere fact that all this intelligence remains latent in the superconscious storehouse means that every individual has within his own power the ability to do things far beyond the reach of his own conscious imagination. Your superconscious is receiving at a constant rate great amounts of information daily. The thoughts of persons everywhere are being projected by their superconscious telecommunication systems to yours. Similarly, your superconscious is sending out to all the fruit of your thoughts. It remains with you, then, to learn to tap this system and bring its message to the conscious level. It is within your power to search through the great memory storehouses of the superconscious and pick out the knowledge that you require at any given time for any given task. Achieving liaison between the conscious and the superconscious levels, between the objective and subjective thought, is a matter of how sensitive you are at any given moment. The sensitivity is a quality which you can and should develop. Unlike the superconscious and supersense, both of which you have been born with, Emotional sensitivity is a power you must develop. It can be developed to a level of great intensity and thus bring you vast treasures. Many creative persons have unwittingly credited this development for the works they have done. We know of the stories told by such men as Edison, Ford, and Marconi about themselves. There are countless other instances of this utilization of the power. Happy ideas come unexpectedly, said the great German scientist Hermann von Helmholtz. They have never come to me when my mind was fatigued or when I was at my work table. Other scientists claim that creative ideas usually flash to them while they are engaged in other activities, the conscious mind then being most receptive to communication with the higher level of the superconscious. In the field of the arts, the same is true. Great musicians have recorded their impressions of this great superconscious power. Wolfgang Mozart said the process of composition is like a vivid dream, referring to the mental activity going on beyond the conscious level of his mind. Peter Tchaikovsky said, the germ of a future composition comes suddenly and unexpectedly. Fontaine Fox, the famous cartoonist of Toonerville Folks, recently recalled shortly before he retired at the young age of 70 that he started to run out of ideas for his comic strip the second day he started drawing the antics of the Toonerville gang. So I followed some early advice of my father's. I went for a long walk. I got an idea and started for the office. I've been rolling ever since on the same theory. The great untapped wealth of a superconscious is yours, too, to develop and use. This telecommunication of the superconscious takes other forms. Some investigators are inclined to disbelieve the phenomenon of mental television, clairvoyance. They believe that this phenomenon belongs in the same category as telepathy. It is their contention that the power to see through the superconscious is strictly thought transference from the superconscious of one person to that of another. A classic example is that of Emanuel Swedenborg's vision of the Great Stockholm Fire in the summer of 1759. Swedenborg was in Gothenburg at the time, 300 miles from his home in Stockholm. Suddenly he became perturbed and announced that there was a big fire in Stockholm. He added that a friend's house had been destroyed by the flames and his own home was in danger of being destroyed by fire. There was no means of rapid communication or travel in those days, of course, and so nothing could be done to confirm or contradict the picture seen by Swedenborg in his mind's eye. 2 hours after his first vision and announcement, Swedenborg said suddenly that the fire had been brought under control only a few doors from his residence. 2 days later, messengers brought the news of the conflagration to Gothenburg, confirming the philosopher's vision in exact detail. This historical incident has all the earmarks of being a case of mental television of the superconscious. Those investigators who believe that the power of clairvoyance is the same as that of telepathy state that it is possible that the information was subjectively communicated through the emotionally excited mind of one of Swedenborg's friends who witnessed the fire, possibly the very person whose house he had seen burn at the time his own abode was threatened. Swedenborg naturally believed he was divinely inspired. He was nearer right than he suspected when he said, "There appertains to every man an internal man, a rational man, an external man, which is properly called the natural man." Scientists still debate the reality of telepathy, clairvoyance, and clairaudience. The mental radio I mentioned before, I know from personal experience they are real. Perhaps the most vivid experience I've had with mental television as a power of the superconscious occurred some years ago. It involved a boy, now a married man, with 2 children of his own, still living in Saginaw, who then lived on the outskirts of that city. His mother used to bring him to my office regularly every Friday morning for several months. One particular day, I saw the boy carrying a large paper bag. I thought nothing of the fact other than he and his mother had probably been shopping before visiting me. When the youth did not seat himself in his customary place and with the first step he took in my direction, I sensed that he had brought me a gift. Not realizing it, I suddenly said, "You brought me 2 quarts of homegrown strawberries?" The boy stopped in his tracks. He was frightened and confused and turned instinctively toward his mother. His own power of reasoning was stunned by incredulity and confusion. The surprised mother asked in astonishment, "How did you know that?" It was my turn to express surprise along with that of my visitors. My frank reply at the moment was, "I really don't know." What happened, in effect, I realized later, was that I actually saw the strawberries. I saw them. despite the fact they were hidden from my sight and other ordinary senses of perception quite securely in a heavy brown paper bag. The skeptical investigator may say it was a demonstration of telepathy, not clairvoyance. Perhaps there was some sort of unusual contact between the boy's mind and mine at that particular moment. Be that as it may, I know that a deep feeling of gratitude was the emotional trigger that caused some particular part of my brain in the superconscious level to flash into action and provide the sight of the gift. I cannot see this incident as being anything else than the power of the superconscious to receive pictures as well as thoughts and sounds. Edgar Cayce's first contact with his superconscious powers of perception was in the form of clairvoyance. As I said before, Cayce was deeply religious, and this spiritual aptitude appeared early in childhood. He delighted in attending Bible meetings and was so impressed by what he heard that by the time he was 10 years old, he decided to read the Holy Bible through once for every year of his life. With 10 years to catch up, all the boy's spare time was spent in reading the Bible and thinking about God. Little wonder that his imagination should dig deeply into the spiritual contents of his collective unconscious. One day at the age of 12, while meditating on things he had read in the Bible, he suddenly saw a lady who looked like his mother. She asked him what he wanted most out of his life. His greatest desire, he said, was to help others, especially children, when they were sick. Young Edgar, though not a dull boy, was uninterested in his schoolwork, and after this incident, he became even less interested in school. His original disinterest started immediately after his first year in school. His teacher then was a pretty soft-spoken, gentle woman who loved children and was loved in return. Under this woman's tutelage, Edgar learned quickly. He liked her, and therefore he was able to please her in this manner. But when she left the school a year later, Edgar's incentive to study was gone. He became listless and could not keep his mind on his work. When he discovered his liking for the Bible, his father, disappointed in the boy's schoolwork, encouraged him by buying a Bible for his son. When not occupied with chores, Edgar read the Bible on his self-appointed task, but never once would he touch homework from school. Reading the Bible became an obsession with the boy, and thus he activated the inherent faculties of his superconscious that normally remain comparatively dormant while the mental development is confined solely to objective learning. Why the appearance of the lady to his mind's eye had anything to do with the boy's increased tack of interest in schoolwork is not known. But by this time, his teacher and uncle, as it happened, complained to the boy's father. The elder Cayce decided to take a hand in the affair and told the boy that his stupidity was a disgrace to the family. He would learn his lessons from then on or else. The first study period set by his father was long and painful evening for the distraught lad. Time and again, his father would hear his spelling lesson. The answers were always wrong. Finally, the father slapped the boy off his chair with the threat of terrible things if he failed again. Young Edgar was tired and sleepy. He remained on the floor where he had been knocked by his father, and suddenly he heard a voice. He recognized it as the voice of the lady he had seen earlier. The voice told him to put the spelling book under his head and go to sleep. The boy closed the book and used it as a pillow and went to sleep. This marked the first instance of Edgar Cayce's long series of experiences in self-hypnosis about which you had already heard. When his father returned, he was fast asleep. The exasperated parent snatched the book from under his head, and no sooner had the boy opened his eyes than the father gave him words to spell. To the amazement of Elder Cayce, the boy spelled every word of the lesson correctly. Young Edgar gleefully informed his father that he could spell every word in the book. The astonished father found this to be correct and accused the boy of having played dumb in school. Edgar was brilliant in spelling from that day on, but he was as dumb as ever in his other studies. He took his other books home with him one day and put them under his head when he went to bed, and then he thought of the lady of his vision and prayed to her until he fell asleep. Again, the wondrous miracle occurred. He awakened to find that he knew the contents of all the books in a single night. Thus, it was a phenomenon of clairvoyance, of mental television, which led Edgar Cayce to discovering the great powers of the superconscious. Those who have never experienced a psychic phenomenon, such visions seem inexplicable, except in a supernatural sense. Visions, clairvoyancy, or as I prefer to term it, mental television, are not to be construed as heaven sent. They are a medium of divine guidance that stems from the level beyond the conscious nurturing spirituality. To those people who have had occasion to meditate for long periods or to concentrate their thoughts on a single quest, as I have in my long search for a solution to the problem of juvenile delinquency, these visions are recognized as symbolic expressions of the reactions of the supersense and the superconscious level of the mind. An example of mental television that I experienced in connection with my research will illustrate the point. I'm indebted to the Catholic Weekly, which printed this experience in its April 8, 1951 edition, for permission to retell it here. I was at the time trying to reconcile the theory of evolution, as developed in the study of anthropology, with the story of the Garden of Eden, which I had been taught by the Good Sisters of St. Mary's. That issue was highly controversial in my conscious thinking, and that is the reason I had difficulty in comprehending the true meaning of the clairvoyant thought I had. Upon awakening from a sound sleep one night, I saw the image of a weighing scale. On one of the balance trays were the words Garden of Eden story, on the other were the words Theory of Evolution. It seemed strange to me at the time that the trays on the scale appeared to be in perfect balance. And all the while, an inexplicable feeling of peace and serenity, such as I never before or since had, permeated my entire being. This experience occurred during the early 40s, when my eldest son was attending the University of Michigan. When he came home to visit the next week, and I told him of my mental television experience. Perhaps he offered me his opinion. The balance of the scales indicates that one theory is as good as the other. He insisted that I consult a local priest, although I felt reluctant at the time to talk about my strange experience, for fear others might think me odd or even conclude that I was losing my sanity. I finally decided to ask one of the older priests if he believed in the theory of evolution. Much to my own surprise, I discovered that he did. Furthermore, he told me that all informed persons now accept the theory as a fact. I concluded that my son's interpretation of my clairvoyant experience was correct. Later, I realized that though the controversial aspects of the two theories would ordinarily have caused me to have some experience of mental confusion, and the resulting upset of my nervous system would have created mental stress and physical discomfort, I was, at the time of the experience, at complete peace and harmony, as I described earlier. The third power of the supersense is that of mental radio clairaudience. This is a faculty that is much more rarely developed than that of the two previously discussed. One dictionary definition of clairaudience is the act or power of hearing in a mesmeric trance sounds which are not audible to the ear in the natural waking condition. I would define it as the faculty of human intelligence that enables the conscious level of one's mind to receive communications by means of the spoken word from the superconscious level of one's own mind or the mind of another person. Power is by no means confined to persons in mesmeric trance, but it seems quite likely that for best results, one should be in a partially subjective state, such as a deep concentration or reverie, to enable oneself to hear clairaudiently his own thoughts of the superconscious, which are frequently communicated to him subjectively by others. The sounds, if one can use that term for something that does not cause atmospheric vibrations, are quite distinct to the conscious of the hearer. They are, however, not at all perceptible to others who may be near the hearer in a normal state. Although clairaudience or mental radio is an entirely different sort of phenomenon from either telepathy, mental telegraphy, and clairvoyance or mental television, it is frequently tied in with some telepathic message from the superconscious. The following illustration may serve as an example. One evening in February 1941, another of my sons, who was then 11 years old, was listening to the radio while I was deeply engrossed in some reading in connection with research I was doing. I was totally unaware of the nature of the radio program to which my son was listening, but suddenly something within me seemed to say, "That's what you're interested in." I turned my attention from the book to the radio in time to hear a speaker talk about some article which had been published in the March issue of the Reader's Digest. I missed hearing what the article concerned. I went back to my reading, but later went to the library to see the issue about which I had heard on the program. I read through the index on the cover, seeking some title that I hoped would lead me to the article I sought. Though actually I had no idea what the article was about, I did not associate any of the titles in the index with what I was interested in at the time. The next step was to read the magazine from cover to cover. No one article seemed to give me any enlightenment on the feeling I had had a few days earlier about the unknown article being discussed. One piece, however, Prayer is Power by Dr. Alexis Carroll, did intrigue me, and I reread it several times. It was only after several readings that I noticed in fine print an editorial reference to Dr. Carroll's book Man the Unknown, a bestseller in 1935. I borrowed this book from the library and found in reading it something in which indeed I was most interested. I've been convinced for many years that the negative attitude held by many leading scientists in regard to so-called extrasensory perception has been a definite block to human progress. These learned men have been reluctant to apply scientific study to this virtually unexplored field. They have instead relegated all such experiences to the category of abnormal psychology. I decided, therefore, to write an article for the purpose of stimulating discussion with a view to doing something about this feeling of the scientists. Being a public servant at the time, I was a little hesitant to offer for publication the article, Mind and Behavior. You will realize my reluctance. I had absolutely nothing to support the conclusion I had reached, and these conclusions were all contrary to accepting academic opinion. All I had was the strength of my own conviction in the value of certain hypotheses of what I called sleep thinking. These were confirmed only by my own experiences and observations, and I was not a scientist, and therefore ought to be ridiculed as a crackpot. Not that I minded the ridicule, but I felt that my only hope in getting anyone interested was in getting some sort of confirmation for my beliefs. In that way, I felt I could make even the most skeptical scientific reader sit up, take at least a little notice. Obviously, it would have been unwise to attempt publication of my unorthodox views without some substantiation. I felt, therefore, the incident of discovering the Dr. Carroll book by the roundabout means of reading the Digest article, led it to it by my clairaudient message, put me on to a most valuable piece of supporting information. In his book, Dr. Carroll wrote, "At the present time, scientists who are concerned solely in the physical and chemical aspects of physiological process still look upon telepathy and other metaphysical phenomena as illusions. Evident facts having an unorthodox appearance are supported by reason of these difficulties. The inventory of the things which could lead us to better understanding of the human being has been left incomplete. There are numerous accounts of mental radio in recorded history. Even the Bible bears out this phenomenon. Plato records that Socrates, the wisest man of all Greece, when that country was in its cultural glory, heard a voice from childhood on. This Greek philosopher, who ranks with the keenest intellects ever produced by the human race, was told of the coming of good and bad by this voice. And Plato adds, the voice sometimes warned Socrates not to do certain things he had been contemplating, warnings which Socrates obeyed. Aristophanes, too, mentions Socrates' extrasensory powers. In his great comedy, The Birds, the playwright has Socrates conducting a seance. Plato tells us that Socrates was sent into a sort of trance state at times. During one of these, it is recorded, the philosopher stood motionless for 24 hours. This motionless condition you will easily recognize as a form of suspended animation produced by self-induced hypnosis. This man, whose wisdom is accepted as unquestioned throughout the world today, was one of the unfortunate individuals with great psychic powers, whom the ignorant of that day put to death for the practice of religious novelties, the same taboo on the so-called occult, which brought death to one of the world's greatest thinkers more than 23 centuries ago, still prevails against honest investigators today. In these past 23 centuries, and in even earlier times, no doubt, how many geniuses have been put to death for being witches, wizards, and dealers with the devil by those persons who would eliminate evidence rather than investigate it scientifically, as the late Dr. Carroll admonished. You and your neighbor feel, and to a great extent rightly, that you live today in an enlightened age. You pride yourselves on the fact that mentally ill persons are no longer put to death because it is believed they are in league with the devil. Yet so many scientists today, in not discriminating between what is destructive and what is constructive, that is to say, between the abnormal and the extra-normal, are actually being a hindrance to human progress. They are no different in their own way from the thinkers of the past, who decried the magic of the early philosophers and healers. The late Dr. Norton Prince, specialist in nervous diseases, once said, "The biographies of saints like Catherine of Siena and Francis, the founder of the Franciscan Order and leaders of religious thought like George Fox, the Quaker, John Bunyan, and Savonarola, to say nothing of minor lights like Savonarola's follower, Fra Silvestre, are replete with accounts of visions and internal voices which once upon a time were interpreted as visitations or supernatural messages of one kind or another. The researchers of recent years in abnormal psychology enable us to understand the genesis of these sensory automatons, even if we cannot explain the exact psychological mechanism. In the light of this knowledge, it becomes clear that they are due to the autogenic influence of the subject's own thoughts, conscious and subconscious, that is, thoughts on the conscious and superconscious levels. Admitting that these phenomena might be due to the autogenic influence of the subject's thoughts on the superconscious level, Dr. Prince covered more territory than he seemingly realized. He was not aware of the exchange of thoughts at the superconscious level of human intelligence. Dr. Prince made the same mistake that many others do in assuming that all sensory automatons are hallucinations. Classifying all extrasensory perceptions as abnormal is as ignorant of the true facts as believing that extranormal manifestations come directly from a supernatural source. One of the best illustrations of the inner voice or mental radio, which people for centuries have mistakenly connected directly with the supernatural, is to be found in a published conversation G. Lloyd Preacher of Atlanta, Georgia, architect and inventor, had with his long-life friend Thomas Alva Edison. In this conversation, Edison said, "Don't give me so much credit for my work. The credit is not all mine. I mean, only that I am merely in the instrument through which a supreme intelligence carries on its work. I am pioneering in undiscovered country and have been from the first. When I began this work, I knew nothing of electrical or mechanical science. My schooling covered little more than a year. If I had not worked under the direction of a supreme intelligence, the work would never have been done at all." Edison worked days and nights with little sleep. He was, he claimed, sustained by the supreme intelligence. He was once asked how and where he was first aware of the divine direction. "It began when I was a telegraph operator in a lonely mountain town," he replied. "I became aware of messages or directions coming clearly into my mind as I sat there through the long nights and began the work which I was directed to do." "But why? I," he was then asked, "have you kept this to yourself?" "Because my work alone was important," Edison replied. "The world would have said Edison is crazy. Edison has got religion." What they said afterward does not matter. Although Edison may or may not have recognized the phenomenon as mental radio and not the voice of God, he was nevertheless quite correct in stating that he was the instrument through which supreme intelligence carried on his work. Are we not all? Edison did not say in so many words, as did the late Dr. George Washington Carver, that he heard God speak to him. Edison merely stated that he became aware of messages or directions coming clearly into his mind while he sat through the long night as a telegraph operator in a lonely little mountain town. The great inventor was indeed fortunate to have had the solitude of this mountain town in combination with a job that required him to spend long, lonely nights as a telegraph operator. That combination of factors left him alone with his own thoughts. Roger W. Babson, the famed economist, recommends this very combination of factors, seclusion and solitude, as a basis for making important decisions. In his helpful book, Before Making Important Decisions, Babson says the seclusion of a quiet church is the place to think over one's problems prior to coming to an important decision. The quiet of the long nights in the seclusion of a telegraph room in a lonely mountain town added together two ideal circumstances for Edison's temperament and mentality. He was a deep thinker who could completely absorb his inner self in research work to the exclusion of both the awareness of time and surroundings. Edison admitted that he feared other people would say he was crazy. It is generally believed that mentally ill persons hear voices, and that is exactly what Edison experienced. But the inventor did not lose the use of his reason during the periods of deep concentration. Instead, he found his real self, and by placing his conscious awareness in a state of temporary abeyance during concentration, he was able to make use of the vastly greater store of intelligence and ability of the superconscious level of his mind. This deeper consciousness is much like a self-induced hypnotic state. It simply means placing consciousness in a neutral state of inactivity while the greater resources of the superconscious are brought into play. The successes of a man, much as Edison, are no greater mystery or secret. Edison did not hesitate to admit that he had not worked under the direction of a supreme intelligence. The work he did would never have been done at all. Had Edison not recognized that the supreme intelligence was within his own being, he certainly would not have stated that his formula for success was simply 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. When Edison said that he worked under the direction of a supreme intelligence, he probably had in mind the fact that few people ever learn how to think as God intended that we should. That is our fault, not his. No one is born without illimitable resources of the superconscious. Medical science has shown in recent years that clairvoyance and clairaudience, mental television and radio, are mechanisms of the human brain. We are told now that these phenomena have no supernatural significance, other than in the sense that God works his wonders through the medium of his handiwork, of which the human organism is perhaps his greatest exhibit. By probing the exposed surface of the human brain with an electrical impulse, researchers have found that memory centers can be activated when electric currents are established. One subject heard the voices of members of his family in a conversation that took place during his early youth. Another saw the scene of a childhood episode in minute detail. The findings of these scientific experiments are obvious. Among many other hypotheses, they confirm the belief that the forces that make the human organism tick are electrochemical vibrations. It is this electrical force that makes telepathy, clairvoyance, and clairaudience possible, much in the same way as wireless telegraphy, television, and radio work. It has often been noted that persons who never develop beyond the stage of idiocy or who have been afflicted with certain forms of insanity have great ability to tame and subdue animals. In such persons, the activity of the conscious level of mind or the sense of reason either is wholly or partially in abeyance, if indeed it has been developed at all. In these persons, then, the superconscious level of the mind is proportionally more active. Could this explain the voices that insane persons hear? Apparently, a telepathic meeting of minds on the subjective animal level of intelligence unconsciously provides some basis for mutual understanding and friendliness between man and beast. At any rate, the immunity of many idiots and so-called holy men, it may be noted, from harm by animals, however ferocious, is proverbial. So numerous are the facts showing the power of the superconscious of mankind over the minds of animals that volumes could be written on the subject. But enough is generally known to realize that the power exists. Under certain well-defined conditions, this power can be exercised by any person of ordinary intelligence. There is, for example, the tradition of Daniel. Of course, Daniel was not an ordinary run-of-the-mill individual. He was a prophet, a seer. In this modern age, he would be known in some circles as a spiritual medium, in others as a mind reader, and yet others as a clairvoyant, all according to the particular conception of each individual as to his powers. The skeptics would, of course, proclaim him a fake. It is the belief of many people, of course, that Daniel was saved from being torn to shreds and eaten by the lions by the power of God. To that I add, amen. But I wish to offer this one opinion. Daniel, being a man possessed of great subjective power, his own animal brain and those of the lions had enough in common to render him immune from harm. This simply because his presence did not excite fear or anger in the beasts. For the still skeptical, let me cite an experiment made in Paris shortly after the turn of the century. It is interesting and should be illuminating in this instance. A young lady was hypnotized and placed in a cage of lions. The object of the experiment is not now known, but its results make that object unimportant in comparison. Just as was Daniel, the young lady was not touched. She showed and had no conscious fear of the king of the beasts, and the lions in turn paid not the slightest attention to her. The adepts of India and even the inferior priests of the Buddhist faith often display their powers by entering jungles so infested by man-eating tigers that an ordinary person would not remain alive an hour. Yet they remain there through the night with no weapons of defense other than the God-given powers of their subjective mental attitudes. The explanation is simple. The subjective power of primitive man were undoubtedly far superior to any now possessed by anyone save perhaps the East Indian adepts and such persons. Before the development of objective means of communication in the form of speech, primitive man conveyed his ideas to his fellow man by telepathic means. Hence the definition of this power as the lost faculty. As man developed the use of speech, through countless generations he ceased to use and finally lost his primitive power to communicate telepathically. Yet despite this fact, among certain primitive tribes, the use of communication on the superconscious level still is in use, much to the amazement of scientific investigators and the consternation of others who stubbornly deny the existence of extrasensory powers of perception. It is written in the Bible that God gave man dominion over the beasts of the field and the fowl of the air. In his prehistoric state, primitive man was destitute of effective weapons of offense or defense, such as were involved during the long ages of later civilizations. Yet man was surrounded by monstrous beasts and reptiles capable of annihilating the present race of civilized people, where the monsters suddenly resurrected and turned loose in their old haunts and numbers, and were we weaponless? Considering this, then, what was the power of our primitive ancestors to assert and maintain his God-decreed dominion over the monsters of his day? It must have been the same power that is exercised now and then by partial or total displacement of objective intelligence. George Ivanovich Gurdjieff summoned up his spiritual philosophy in five simple words: the harmonious development of man. Man, the Russian philosopher said, is an unfinished product. Nature had evolved him up to a certain stage, then man was left to his own devices to struggle to a higher level of consciousness, or to remain as he was, an incomplete being. The question remains for us to answer then: can modern man utilize more of the hidden power of his natural heritage? Can man bring into play the full powers of the golden gift of the great creative force? I say he can. Through intellectual and spiritual development, by eliminating the destructive effects of the many negative feeling attitudes which stem from primitive fear and anger, it can be accomplished. The golden gift is yours. God has granted it for your use. Within the superconscious, there lies the supersense for you to use and utilize, for you to spend in positive production for the benefit of yourself and mankind. The hidden power need not be hidden to you. You have read how to unlock it. You have seen how it can be used for the positive good. You've been shown how you can benefit by it. And yet this treasure that has been granted you by the power of infinite intelligence is not one for which you have to wait to use. It is within your grasp now. Its benefits can be reaped now. Its beauties are apparent now. All that is asked of you is understanding of the greatness and immensity of the golden gift. You must meditate. You must send yourself into the open space of deeper consciousness. You must search out the power within yourself. Then, all that is becomes yours. God's treasury of wisdom will open to you. It is your rightful possession, a possession you have long had and until now have not used. And this concludes Rediscovering Your Supersense, an amazing chapter from the book Magic Power of Your Mind. And Walter Germain was a great writer. And on one level, I just love his discussion of Edgar Cayce. There's some things that I've learned about Edgar Cayce from this that I had not learned previously. I've read his book and some of the biographical information about Cayce. But when we have people like Cayce who have developed their superconscious sense, those are the people that we need to model. And in some cases, they may seem somewhat insane. But in a trance state, if you can divorce your conscious self and open yourself to a supreme intelligence, then some amazing things happen. This is what happens when you enter into a social memory complex. This was written a long time ago, but it's talking about the social memory complex. When that awakens, we become fully aware of the superconscious. It becomes an aspect of our conscious, just like having a new computer with an advanced software, or connecting one computer to a whole dozen of other computers, how it would improve in its ability. So it's important to understand there's a superconscious sense, a sense that can be used for mental radio, for mental television, and is incredibly powerful. And I still don't think we do enough. We're not taught enough about it. In school, we're told that it's not real. We're told even in our churches that it's not real. And it is real. These resources that we can get from the superconscious is an amazing thing. And it's our super sense. You've used it before. And it's just time for you to remember how to use it again and to enter into another consciousness, which is a different way of living. Just like putting on a virtual reality headset would be a different form of consciousness. There is another level of consciousness, being aware of multiple thoughts at the same time. There's a greater complexity to the environment that you're in because you're accessing this God mind, which is a collection of everybody's superconscious thoughts. And I say that you need to embrace this and be aware of it. That's what's happening as we're moving in to this fourth density environment. We're awakening to the superconscious as a real physical thing in our thought processes. And I wouldn't be surprised at some point if scientists prove it. It will be proven. In any case, I'd love to get your opinions of this discussion of the superconscious and the super sense. You can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com, and welcome to The Reality Revolution.